turn now to the next case of the morning, number 01307, Rodriguez against Walls. Mr. Wynn.
May it please the court, my name is Harris Wynn, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Juan Rodriguez. Rodriguez appealed from a June 26th decision of the Northern District, which held that he had procedurally defaulted upon the Sixth Amendment right of confrontation claim raised in his habeas corpus petition. This decision was premised upon two legal errors, and therefore should be reversed. First, the district court erroneously concluded that Rodriguez did not fully present his Sixth Amendment claim to the Illinois Appellate Court. Second, the district court erroneously held that the Illinois Appellate Court's rejection of the Sixth Amendment claim was based upon independent and adequate state law grounds, and therefore it was precluded from asserting habeas corpus jurisdiction. The district court's ruling that Rodriguez failed to fairly present the substance of his federal claim to the Illinois Appellate Court is completely at odds with the applicable legal standard. The law pertaining to the issue of fair presentment is clear. In Day versus Attorney General of New York, the Second Circuit noted that fair presentment requires only that the nature or presentation of a claim is likely to alert the state court that a federal claim is being asserted. This court, in Verdin versus O'Leary, explains the task of a habeas court in adjudicating the issue of fair presentment is assessing whether the state tribunal was alerted to the claim's federal nature. On a number of occasions, this court, as well as the First and Second Circuit, has explained that if a habeas petitioner asserts a claim in terms so particular as to call to mind a specific constitutional right, a federal court will regard a state court as having had a fair opportunity to consider the federal claim. In Bay, the Second Circuit also noted that a state court will be alerted to the federal nature of the claim if the defendant has claimed the deprivation of a right specifically protected by the Constitution. This is precisely what Rodriguez did in the Illinois Appellate Court. On four separate occasions in his brief before that court, Rodriguez made the following explicit statement. Juan Rodriguez was deprived of his Sixth Amendment right to confront the witnesses against him. In the face of repeated utterances of the statement, there is simply no reasonable scenario whereby a court cannot be alerted that a federal claim is being asserted. In order to prevail, the government must show that having read this brief heading on four separate occasions, the Illinois Appellate Court was nevertheless not informed that Rodriguez was asserting a federal claim. The district court committed a second error when it ruled that the Illinois Appellate Court's dismissal of Rodriguez's claim was based upon an independent and adequate state law grounds that precluded its review. Here, too, the law is clear. On a number of occasions, the Supreme Court has stated that a procedural default does not bar consideration of a federal claim unless the state court clearly and expressly states that its judgment rests upon a state procedural bar. This did not occur in the appellate court. Having been alerted to Rodriguez's claim that his right of confrontation had been violated, the Illinois Appellate Court, one, held that the claim had been waived, two, nonetheless proceeded to evaluate the merits of the claim, three, concluded that errors had been made, and four, concluded that such errors were harmless. In effect, the Illinois Appellate Court held that the deprivation of Rodriguez's Sixth Amendment confrontation claim was a harmless error. This being so, the district court's ruling that the Illinois Appellate Court's decision did not invoke any federal law and is therefore immune from federal review is clearly erroneous. Faced with an identical situation, the Northern District in Galvin versus Gilmore ruled correctly. Galvin, the petitioner in this case, after his convictions for aggravated arson and murder were affirmed, and after all state court remedies had been exhausted, sought a writ of habeas corpus on the basis that his Sixth Amendment and Fourth Amendment rights had been violated. As was the case in the district court below, the state and Galvin argued that because Galvin had failed to raise these claims in his post-conviction petition, the claims had been waived, and therefore Galvin's habeas petition should be dismissed on the basis of procedural forfeiture. In evaluating the merit of this contention, the court in Galvin noted that although the appellate court had ruled the claims had been waived by not filing them on a timely basis, the appellate court nevertheless evaluated the merit of the federal claims and ruled that even had the alleged constitutional values taken place, they would not have changed the outcome of Galvin's trial. In the words of the district court in Galvin, since the state court did not clearly and expressly base its decision on the procedural default, but instead considered and resolved the merits of the claims presented, an independent and adequate state law ground does not support the decision. The district court in Galvin then went on to consider whether the state court's handling of the federal claims was correct. This is precisely what should have occurred in the district court below. Your Honor, in view of the two affirmation reversible errors committed by the district court, I respectfully request that the matter be remanded for reconsideration, and I reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal if there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Parrish. Mr. Wynn. Ms. Smith, we'll hear from you now.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, Assistant Attorney General Lisa Smith, appearing on behalf of the respondent. The respondent asserts today, and as it has before the district court, that the district court properly determined that the petitioner's claim was defaulted based on an independent and adequate state law ground. It's clear that the Illinois Appellate Court concluded that the petitioner had defaulted his claim solely on that independent and adequate state law basis. The Appellate Court couldn't have been actually any more clear. They were faced with a petitioner who was represented by counsel in the Appellate Court, and that counsel conceded that they had waived the claim because it had not been raised in a post-trial motion as required by Illinois statute. So counsel asked the Appellate Court specifically to conduct a plain error analysis to see if that waiver could be excused. The Appellate Court did specifically that. They acknowledged the waiver. They acknowledged that counsel had conceded the waiver. They explained the plain error analysis according to state law. And then they, instead of looking at the merits, what they actually did, they conducted a weighing of the evidence to see if the evidence was so closely balanced as to excuse that default. In this case, the Appellate Court decided that it was not closely balanced. They considered the petitioner's other confessions on three separate occasions, the knowledge of where his victim had been struck, as well as the other evidence of his mental state. Furthermore, in order for that state ground to be considered independent and adequate, the state must clearly and expressly rely on it. And that's exactly what happened here. The Appellate Court, as I said, could not have been more clear. This court has already determined that a review for plain error does not cure a procedural default in the case of Neal versus Granley. Therefore, it is our position that the district court properly found this claim procedurally defaulted. As to the fair presentment claim that counsel raises, we recognize that this court in Verdon versus O'Leary has adopted the approach outlined in New York, Day versus New York, that sets forth four factors. However, this court has also stated that the presence of any of these factors does not automatically avoid a waiver, as this court can review and consider the facts in each case. If this is done, it is apparent that the true issue as argued before the appellate court was really one of hearsay. It's important to remember that counsel was appointed, the petitioner was had the benefit of counsel at the appellate court in structuring his arguments. And to that event, what he argued in clear substance was a hearsay issue, not a Sixth Amendment right to confront a witness. The petitioner cites Nadworny versus Thayer in support of his proposition that he did alert the court. However, a closer look at Nadworthy also cautions, and I'm quoting from Nadworny on page 1101, "We do not mean to suggest that an isolated federal law bloom in a garden thick with state law references will serve. This is exactly the case that we have here. We have three or four references to a right opposed to 17 or 18 claims of hearsay." We clearly have that, as Nadworny has noted. The Nadworny court also held that federal claims to the state courts have to be properly unveiled. And I do not believe that that was done in this case. Because we feel that the petitioner has not presented his claim fairly and unveil is required, we believe the district court properly found that those claims have been defaulted. In closing, I would ask that this court respectfully request that the decision of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Wynn. Mr. Wynn, I believe, has 5 minutes left.
Your Honors, I would first reassert that it's simply unreasonable to say that an Illinois appellate court can read a brief that on four occasions claims that a petitioner has been deprived of a Sixth Amendment right and yet not be alerted that a federal claim has been asserted. I would also say that there's a clear relationship between hearsay and violation of the Sixth Amendment. In the absence of a recognized exception to the hearsay rule, the introduction of hearsay testimony is a principal means by which a petitioner can be deprived of a Sixth Amendment confrontation claim. Once he alerted the Illinois appellate court that his Sixth Amendment rights had been violated, Rodriguez properly and necessarily had to discuss hearsay because it was the vehicle by which his rights were violated. There just wasn't much more he could have done to alert the court that a federal claim has been asserted. So I just take issue with the government's claim that the district court did not assert the claim.
Well, I haven't looked at all the underlying arguments that were made, but were they all state hearsay arguments? And we know that confrontation clause and hearsay rules are not necessarily the same. What was argued?
Well, his argument
did he argue federal constitutional confrontation clause issues or only state hearsay issues?
His brief before the Illinois appellate court did consist primarily of state hearsay issues. I would just note that this court in Verdun and the Second Circuit in Day noted that in addition to the citation of federal cases, it is sufficient simply to assert a claim the deprivation of specific constitutional right in order to alert, you know, that a federal claim is being asserted. So that's sufficient. These are mutually exclusive routes. You don't have to cite federal cases as long as there is something else that was had alerted the Illinois appellate court that a federal claim is being raised. And what's at stake here is the difference between manslaughter and murder is just a question of intent. The testimony that was admitted was extremely prejudicial. The jury was allowed to hear hearsay testimony that the petitioner had rammed a 4-year-old's head repeatedly against the floor. The introduction of this testimony also allowed the introduction of a chart which, you know, highlighted these injuries. In the absence of this testimony, the hearsay testimony, it is possible that the jury would have not been inflamed and would have, you know, convicted on, you know, for a second-degree murder or manslaughter.
So how did the little boy's testimony differ from the confession?
Well, I don't think that the defendant confessed to the beating of the murderer's head. And I would say that having a detective in open court, you know, say that, you know, I talked to a child, he said that his brother's head had been rammed against the floor. Hearing it from a detective, I think that is something that's more prejudicial. It is prejudicial.
Well, what did the detective say the defendant told him about what happened to the victim's head?
Now, I'm not sure that in the record that there were a number of admissions made, but I don't think that there was an admission that he had, you know, hit the child's head against the floor. There was an admission that he had struck the child in the sternum or the chest, and, you know, it was later determined that this injury was the injury that actually caused the death. It wasn't the beating of the head. That was just, you know, extra evidence of abuse. And I submit that had that evidence not been in the record, that, you know, there is a likelihood that Mr. Rodriguez would have been convicted of manslaughter or second-degree murder as opposed to first degree. Thank you,
Mr. Wynn. Mr. Wynn, we want to thank you for taking this case as appointed counsel. Thank you and your law firm for having rendered this fine service both to your client and to the court. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel for their fine submissions, and the case will be taken under advisement.